This story is inspired from a true incident which happened in the year 2017 in Los Angeles. A guy aged 45 years of age went on a rampage of not paying for his high-end dinner dates. More about this after the story. Rachel and I dated for nearly a year. I spent money on lavish dinners, spontaneous trips, and over-the-top gifts. She was the first woman I'd ever felt so strongly about, and so I spared no expense. My friends cautioned me, but I brushed off their concerns. To me, she was perfect. I believed that investing in love was an investment in our future. When I finally found out she'd been seeing someone else on the side, and worse, had been bragging about my generosity to her friends, it felt like a piece of my soul had been torn out. The revelation came through a mutual acquaintance who couldn't bear to see me deceived any longer. "You deserve to know the truth," he had told me in a hushed tone. "She's been seeing a guy named Daniel for months. I didn't want to get involved, but it's gone too far." I confronted Rachel that same night. It was in my apartment's living room. I still remember how the glow of the floor lamp cast long shadows against the wall as I stood there with my heart pounding. "You've been cheating on me, haven't you?" I asked, my voice trembling. She just looked at me, arms crossed, an unrepentant look in her eyes.
"Martin, you should have seen this coming. We want different things."
"Different things?" I repeated, choking on disbelief. "I thought we both wanted an honest relationship." She shrugged.
"Eh, you're sweet, but not enough. Besides, you're always so eager to pay. I never stopped you, did I?"
That night, I didn't sleep. Something fundamental in me cracked. And the man who woke up the next morning was not the same as the one who had fallen asleep. I was angry, bitter, and humiliated. For weeks, I refused to talk to anyone. My friend David, my closest confidant, tried to drag me out of my depression, but I would only grunt responses. I was obsessed with the idea that I had been used, that my goodwill was just currency in someone else's game. Months passed. Gradually, I returned to dating, though I was more cautious than ever. During a dinner date with someone named Fiona, whom I had met through a friend, I felt history repeating itself. She kept talking about her expensive tastes and her love of material gifts. My gut twisted with anger at the memory of Rachel. By the time the waiter brought the bill, my date was already expecting me to pay. She tapped her manicured nails on the table as if it were the most natural thing in the world.
"Are you picking this up?" she asked, her tone confident.
I don't know what overtook me in that moment. Maybe it was the memory of Rachel's smug face, or maybe it was the deep-seated need to protect myself from ever being used again. I shot up from the chair, mumbled something about using the restroom, and slipped out the back door. My heart pounded with adrenaline as I walked briskly away from the restaurant, the cold night air stinging my skin. I imagined the shock on Fiona's face when the waiter would return to find me gone and her alone with the bill. I should have felt guilty. Instead, I felt a twisted kind of triumph. It was a high, an odd rush that made me feel in control for the first time since Rachel. I told David about it the next day over coffee.
"You did what?"
He nearly spat out his drink.
"Martin, that's messed up. Why would you do that?"
I shrugged, trying to appear nonchalant.
"She was just another gold digger, man. She didn't care about me. Only what I could buy for her."
He shook his head disapprovingly.
"I get that you're hurt, but this is not a healthy way to cope. You're going to attract the wrong kind of attention."
Soon, I found myself concocting a plan. I started visiting dating apps and intentionally looking for profiles that hinted at a history of cheating or boasted about wanting someone who could afford luxury. It wasn't hard to find them. People can be surprisingly open about their desires online. Once I identified a target, I would strike up a conversation, making sure to dangle just enough hints about my own so-called wealth to pique their interest. My next victim was a woman named Sylvia, who boasted in her profile about wanting the finer things in life and being allergic to cheap dinners. I found her transparent greed oddly convenient. I matched with her and we chatted for a week. When we finally met at a top-tier steakhouse, she didn't hesitate to order the most expensive entree. She spent the entire night telling me about her needs and how she only dated men who could afford her lifestyle. My blood simmered as she talked. It was like listening to a remix of Rachel's old lines. When the waiter slid the bill onto our table, I excused myself to take a phone call. I vanished into the night once more, leaving her to foot the exorbitant check. Words of my stunts began to spread, though I was careful not to use my real name on these dates. I created false identities, used different phone numbers, and always picked restaurants scattered across the city. To me, it felt like a game of cat and mouse, and I was winning. Every time I left a woman scrambling to pay, I felt a grim sense of victory. Of course, not everyone took it lying down. Some of these women complained to restaurant managers, who, in turn, started reporting these incidents to the police. A few recognized me on social media and posted warning messages. David caught wind of one such post online and confronted me in person. "Martin, you need to stop this," he said, pulling out his phone and showing me a screenshot of a furious rant from one of my dates. "They're calling you the dinner skipper. It's not a good look, man." I rolled my eyes. "They can call me whatever they want. I'm done being someone's checkbook." "You're gonna get caught," David insisted, face red with frustration. "And then what? You'll end up in jail with a record for fraud or theft or something worse." I waved him off. "I'm not stealing. I'm just leaving. They can't pin me for that unless they have proof. Besides, these so-called victims are not exactly saints themselves." Next, I matched with Linda, a woman whose profile boasted about her taste for designer clothes and upscale vacations. She wrote that she'd cheated on past partners because they were too boring. In my warped mind, she was the perfect candidate for a lesson. I set up a dinner at one of the most exclusive French restaurants in town. The kind where reservations are made months in advance, and the bill alone could bankrupt someone with an average salary. When Linda arrived, she was wearing a dress that probably cost more than my monthly rent. She smiled sweetly, though her eyes seemed to size me up like a prize steer. We ordered champagne, escargot, and a main course that included a heaping portion of lobster. As the night wore on, she talked about her many admirers, how some had funded her shopping sprees, and how she expected nothing less from a potential partner. I forced a charming smile through all her stories, making sure she believed I was enthralled. The second the waiter placed the check on the table, I pulled out my well-practiced excuse about stepping outside to take a call. I grabbed my coat and walked confidently toward the door. The moment I stepped outside, two men in dark suits approached me. One flashed a badge. My heart plummeted. "Martin Reeves?" the man asked sternly. I hesitated. "Who's asking?" He pocketed his badge. "We've had several reports of you leaving women to foot the bill. Complaints from restaurant owners, too. You're under arrest." I froze, half in disbelief. Behind me, Linda stood in the doorway, arms crossed, an icy look of triumph on her face.
"Guess I'm not the only one who likes to cheat people," she spat,
They handcuffed me right there on the sidewalk. A small crowd gathered, whispering and taking pictures with their phones. The adrenaline that once fueled my escapes now turned to cold sweat trickling down my back. I was driven to the station, processed, and locked in a cell that reeked of stale sweat and cheap disinfectant. From May of 2016 to April of 2018, a man aged 45 defrauded at least 10 women in Los Angeles, leaving them to pay over $950 worth of restaurant bills. This man, who was nicknamed the Dinner Scammer, would take dates to upscale restaurants, order extravagant meals featuring steak and shrimp, and then leave without paying. Prosecutors revealed that 8 women were left with the bills, while restaurants bore the cost in 2 instances. In court, the man pleaded no contest to charges of fraud and petty theft. A judge sentenced him to 120 days in jail, 3 years of probation, and banned him from using dating apps. One victim quipped, quote, "He doesn't have to worry about meals now. He gets 3 square meals a day."
This story is inspired from a true incident that happened in the year 2015 in New York in a beauty salon. More about the incident after the story. I remember the day I first met Kevin as clearly as I recall the moment I left him. Back then, I was a naive 20-year-old, searching for validation in a world that felt too big. He was charming at first, courteous, attentive, always quick to defend me if anyone stepped out of line. It took me 7 years to realize that his protective instincts were nothing but a facade, masking a toxic possessiveness that nearly broke me. I decided to leave him on a cold autumn evening. I felt suffocated by his jealousy. He would demand to know my every move, where I was, who I was with, and why I hadn't answered his call within seconds. When the final argument came, it happened in my tiny apartment, among scattered boxes, as I was prepared to move out. He stood by the door, clenching his fist so hard his knuckles went white. "You think you can run from me, Nest?" he spat out. "I gave you everything." "You gave me nothing but fear," I replied, grabbing the last of my things. My voice wavered, but I had to stand my ground. "I'm done with this." From that point on, I tried to distance myself. I applied for a job as a cashier at a nearby beauty salon, hoping for a fresh start. The salon was bright and modern, with glittering floor-to-ceiling mirrors and colorful displays of luxury products. It provided a strange comfort, an escape from the dark memories Kevin's presence had woven into my life. My new boss, Brandon, was the polar opposite of Kevin. He managed the salon with professionalism and kindness, always addressing me and the other staff with respect. He had a warm smile that revealed a gentle sincerity, and he never pried into my personal life. Over time, we grew closer. I found myself drawn to him, not just because he was handsome, but because he treated me like I mattered. One evening, we stayed late to tally the day's earnings, which was when I first opened up. "Brandon," I said softly, setting down my pen, "I haven't been honest about my past." He looked up from the receipts, concern in his eyes. "You don't have to tell me anything if you don't want to." "No, I want to," I said, steeling myself. I was in a relationship for 7 years with someone who, well, was extremely controlling. It ended badly, and now I'm always looking over my shoulder. Brandon didn't judge. Instead, he reached out and squeezed my hand gently. "You're safe here, Nest. I promise you that." It wasn't long after our relationship started that Kevin began lurking around the salon. I'd glance up from the register and see a figure in the distance, hidden behind tinted car windows or standing behind a corner traffic light. At first, I thought it was just my imagination, conjured by the lingering fear of our past. But then, I started getting text messages from an unknown number. One read, "I see you." Another read, "Don't get too comfortable with your new manager." Worse than the messages, though, was the knowledge that Kevin knew I had a deep-seated phobia of masks. Brandon noticed my anxiety growing. One day, he confronted me in his office, Nest, you're jumping at every sound. Did something happen again? I hesitated before answering. I got another text this morning, and I saw someone standing outside the salon last night, wearing some sort of face covering. Brandon's expression hardened. That's it. I'm installing a panic button under the cashier counter. If anything happens, you'll be able to press it. Those words gave me a little bit of comfort, but not enough to quell the nightmares. About a week later, it all came to a head. It was a Friday, usually the busiest day at the salon. Women and men came in, prepping for weekends full of parties and romantic dates. I stood at the cashier desk, scanning products and chatting warmly with the clients, hoping to mask my own apprehension. Brandon worked in his office in the back, discussing supply deliveries with a vendor over the phone. Suddenly, I heard footsteps outside that sounded heavier than normal. When I glanced at the front door, I saw him. Kevin, he was there, wearing the most horrendous wolf mask imaginable. My heart felt as though it stopped. He pushed the door open. Immediately, all conversation in the salon had died. His ragged breathing echoed behind the mask as he scanned the room, looking for Brandon. All I could do was stand there, blood hammering in my ears. Every fiber of my being told me to scream, to run, but I was paralyzed. Kevin, I managed to gasp, my knees threatening to buckle. He tilted his head, mocking me with a distorted wolf grin. Then he moved towards the counter with deliberate steps. I remember what Brandon said about the button. I reached under the counter and slammed my hand against the panic button. Kevin's voice, muffled by the mask, was chilling.
Where is your manager?
He asked.
Where's that new boyfriend of yours?
I could see the other customers shrinking back, fear evident in their eyes. Part of me wanted to shout for them to run, but the words wouldn't come out. I tried to hold Kevin's gaze, though it was nearly impossible with the horrifying mask. At that moment, Brandon appeared from the back hallway. He stepped between Kevin and me, fist clenched at his sides.
Leave, Kevin, he said firmly. You have no business here.
Kevin snarled.
You think you can just take her from me? You don't know what you're getting into.
Brandon wasn't intimidated.
She chose to leave you. You lost her when you tried to control her.
What happened next was like a rush of chaotic images. Kevin lunged forward, knocking over a display of lotions and shouting. But just as he raised his arm, we all heard a wail of sirens blaring in the distance. The security button had done its job. Help was seconds away. Kevin froze, realizing his plan to attack Brandon and drag me away had been thwarted. In a final act of desperation, he spun around and ripped the cash register from the drawer. He stuffed the loose bills into his jacket and ran away. I took a shaky step backwards, feeling the adrenaline surge through me. Customers looked on in shock, and Brandon reached for me, pulling me into a protective embrace. When the police arrived, I could hardly speak. My breath became ragged gasps, and I clung to Brandon like a lifeline. We explained what had happened the best we could, how Kevin showed up and disguised, and how he threatened us, how he stole from the salon's cash register. The officers dispersed quickly, and their radios crackling with orders to pursue him. In April 2015, a masked robber struck a New York beauty salon in Spring Valley. Wearing a wolf's mask, the suspect entered Kelly's unisex salon at 4 p.m., brandishing a knife and demanding cash. The frightened employee, a 31-year-old woman, placed the money into a backpack he provided before he fled the scene. She was unharmed and quickly called 911. Authorities released surveillance footage to aid in identifying the suspect, described as 5'4 to 5'7 with a medium build. The police continued their search, urging the public for any leads.
This story is inspired from a true incident which happened in San Diego 4 years ago. A woman reported a break-in to a bank. More about the incident after the story. I'd been on the streets for months, drifting from one bustling neighborhood to another. In that time, I met all kinds of drifters and mischief makers. My two closest pals were Marty and Lucy, both as fond of shortcuts and thrill-seeking as I was. Marty had once orchestrated a string of petty restaurant thefts, and I joined him whenever I felt especially hungry or bored. Lucy, on the other hand, was the brains of our trio. She could charm her way into any party or building, spinning tales so convincing you'd swear she was royalty. We'd spent that evening behind the old bus depot, passing around a bottle. Lucy started joking about how I was fearless when it came to getting what I wanted. She said, "Jenny, you'll do anything to eat, right?" I laughed, a warm buzz in my head. You know me too well. "Food first, trouble second." Marty leaned in, eyes dancing with the kind of excitement only booze can bring. He said, "I dare you to sneak into the nearest building and use their microwave to heat up these." He pulled two frozen hot pockets from his coat pocket, brandishing them like they were contraband. "You're out of your mind," I replied, laughing. But I was already intrigued. As someone who once stole lobster from a five-star restaurant's kitchen, I wasn't exactly above a foolish dare. Plus, the thought of that warm, gooey snack had my stomach growling. "It'll be fun," Lucy chimed in. "Think of it like our signature stunt. No one else would be crazy enough to do it." I grinned, grabbed the hot pockets, and shoved them into my own pocket. I was wearing a black hoodie, black pants, basically dressed like a stereotypical robber. We stumbled down the street until we spotted a tall building with bright lights still on. I assumed it was just another office complex, maybe with a staff lounge that had a microwave. In my drunken state, I ignored the giant bank logo shining above the entrance. Lucy nudged me. "Go on, Jenny. Show them what you're made of." I took a deep breath, pulled the hood over my head, and slipped through the front doors. It was late, so the lobby was almost empty. In my hazy mind, I thought I could just sneak around until I found a break room or something that resembled a kitchen. The security guard was nodding off at his post, and I slunk past him, heart pounding in my chest. I should have realized something was wrong when I noticed bulletproof glass windows and huge steel doors leading to rooms marked vault. But I was on a mission for a snack, so I didn't dwell on it. Finally, I spotted a small staff lounge tucked in a corner. I let out a little whoop of triumph when I saw a microwave on the counter. I popped in the first hot pocket, pressing the start button. The whir of the microwave was like music to my ears. I was so caught up in watching that rotating pastry that I didn't notice someone standing behind me until I heard a gasp. A woman in a blazer stood there, eyes wide with alarm. Before I could speak, she bolted out of the lounge. Panic glanced through me, but all I could think was I better grab my hot pocket before I run.
"Stop! You're not supposed to be here!"
The security guard shouted, charging into the room, but it was too late for warnings. The woman had already called the police, convinced I was some armed burglar. Sirens wailed in the distance, and my heart sank. "Just my luck," I muttered, yanking open the microwave to grab my barely warmed hot pocket. Marty and Lucy were nowhere in sight, probably waiting for me outside. Or maybe they run off once they realize which building I entered. When the cops burst in, guns drawn, I held up my hands, the steaming snack still clutched in one fist. One officer, a tall, gruff-looking man, blinked in confusion.
"What the? Are you heating up food?"
he asked, disbelief dripping from every syllable.
"Listen, it's not what it looks like,"
I stammered, half laughing and half terrified.
"I was just warming up dinner."
The second cop, a wiry woman with sharp eyes, took one look at my clothes and shot back.
"Oh, I'm sure this is just a big misunderstanding, right?"
I shrugged, trying to stay calm.
"I swear I didn't mean to break in. I'm just hungry."
But there was no mercy in their eyes. They patted me down, cuffed me, and marched me outside to a chorus of flashing lights. Marty and Lucy were gone, and I felt a surge of betrayal. My so-called friends had dared me into this fiasco and then vanished when the heat got too intense. 4 years ago, on a quiet Wednesday morning in Chalice View, San Diego police responded to a security alarm at a Wells Fargo bank. arriving just after 3:15 a.m., officers discovered a shattered window and learned from security cameras that a man was still inside. The suspect, a homeless man seeking food, broke in to heat Hot Pockets in the break room microwave, eating two sandwiches before being apprehended. Officers with guns drawn ordered him to surrender, eventually sending in a K-9 to ensure compliance. The man was arrested without incident. No injuries were reported.
It was going to be one of the best days of my career. It had been a long couple of weeks of interviews, reference checks, and phone calls, but I'd finally gotten a new job. I put on my new outfit and checked myself in the mirror after a minute of patting my cat who slept on the corner of my desk. I knew that my father would have been proud had he seen me come this far. Outside, the sun neared the horizon line, and I knew that it was time to get moving. It wasn't a long drive from my house, but by the time I pulled out, the sky already sparkled with a few sightings of stars. The gate was open, allowing me to pull in and find a parking spot where the other security guard met me.
"Well, that's all of them," he said as he was getting into his truck. "The park is all yours, kid. Call me if you have any questions or concerns." I nodded, then closed the gate after he drove out and onto the main road.
As I turned, I took in the sight of the rolling hills, covered in headstones and small mausoleums at the hill peaks, like lighthouses towering over the graveyard. As the night fell, only the lampposts along the walkway illuminated the area, and not very well. Though the graveyard was massive, and they'd permitted me the use of the golf cart, I decided to walk for the first night. It was nice to take my time to learn the area. It astounded me how many rows upon rows of gravestones filled the fields of pristinely cut grass. Several of them had flowers set beside them, but most of them were barren with little fissures and crumbles. Being one of the largest graveyards in the States, the place was constantly growing and expanding new plots for the never-ending supply of the dead. As I passed the first mausoleum, I took out my flashlight and checked the area. I was informed that squatters would use the mausoleums as a makeshift home for the evening. I'm not sure how anyone was comfortable with sharing a sleeping quarters with the dead, but it was one of the bigger problems with the graveyard. The other problem was that many of the older mausoleums were made with valuable decorations that were starting to go missing. A few hours had passed with nothing eventful except a few raccoons attempting to break into one of the dumpsters. It was the loud plink noise that caught my attention, but it was an echo from far away and hard to distinguish where it was coming from. As I started to look for the source, all the lampposts in the graveyard flickered, then shut off completely. Though I could see where I was walking from the moonlight, I still removed my flashlight. I'd been told that the power system, being older, would shut off from time to time, and only required resetting the power, which was by the entrance of the graveyard. I decided to investigate the cause of the noise before resetting the power. A strange eeriness filled the graveyard where the light once stood. Another clink gave me a destination. One of the oldest mausoleums towards the back of the lot was the source. I turned off my flashlight and silently approached the mausoleum. I crouched low to remain covered in the shadows, then jumped out to catch the perpetrator. But it was empty. The stone tomb inside was open. When I peeked into the tomb, I found it completely empty, and along the edge was a dirty trail. My heart began throbbing as my imagination jumped to a level I wouldn't normally think about. Was the dead walking around the graveyard? I decided to go fix the light system. If I was going to find the dead walking around the surface, I'd rather do so in the light. When I approached the control panels of the lighting, I flicked the required switches to reset the system. Not even a slight buzz through the wires, and none of the lights returned to life. A movement out in the yard caught my attention, and I abandoned the quest of fixing the lights until I thoroughly checked the area. I took silent steps as I approached the area, and I could hear little shuffles of movement. I leaped from my hiding spot, and my heart sank as my fears stood before me. A skeletal face looked at me from a mossy, leaf-covered body. In my frozen fear, the creature turned and dashed away from me, which allowed me to catch a glimpse of the gold-plated plaque in its grasp. Without another thought, I chased that figure. I slipped on the grass, but I found my footing and made up the distance. The undead intruder didn't seem to run as fast as myself. When I neared, I dove and wrapped my hands around the creature. I assumed I'd be wrapping my hands around a thin skeletal frame, but there was a body filled with muscle and meat. We collapsed to the ground, nearly breaking a headstone that met our force. We tussled around for a moment, until I pried the plaque into my hand and the unwanted guest pushed away from me. As he returned to his feet, the Halloween skeleton mask fell from his face and I got a good look at him. I considered holding him down, but there would be no use in it as I had nothing to bind him, so I let him free, where he ran towards the border of the graveyard and vanished into the night. The police took their sweet time arriving at the area where I filed my report, and we searched the light systems to find that the wires had been cut in several places. Upon further searching, we found the location of the stolen plaque, as well as a grave that had been dug up. Who knows what sort of things he found buried with the dead, if anything at all. The undertaker wasn't thrilled about the handiwork, but it wasn't too hard to set the place back into order. I got the system fixed and recommended a few things to my boss so that we could keep the masked bandits from getting off with anything valuable from the graveyard. Though I described the robber to the police, I know that he's still out there stalking graveyards under the guise of the dead, prying cheap finds from the dead.